Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming from our studios in New York City. And I welcome you. Today, this is called the Talk Back Hour. It's your opportunity to call in for the entire program and share the concerns you have, the questions you have, the insights. Our number is 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. I'd like to welcome our sister station in New York, WBAI, and in Washington, D.C., WPFW, and other stations around the United States. I'm going to talk at the beginning of our program about the latest information on how to deal with cancer using just one new nutrient that is getting a lot of good attention. Also, there is a sweetener. It's a natural sweetener. It's called xylitol. And for those of you who are concerned about low-calorie sweeteners and you're thinking of aspartame, well, when I tell you what this does, I think you'll see that there is certainly no choice. You're going to take something that's natural, non-toxic. Also today, the latest on acid levels in your diet could have profound effects on your kidney health. This is Science Daily saying this. This is mainstream science finally acknowledging the work of the great natural hygienist of the 1920s right up through the 1980s. And they were right that if we eat highly acidic food with very little alkaline foods and beverages, it causes all forms of biochemical abnormalities in the body. So I'll get to that as well. Time permitting, I'll also give you the latest on what men can do in depth about the prostate gland. Then from our environmental segment, genetically modified organisms for profit, the missing context in industrial agriculture, from Curtis Rise from Truthout. Also, fears confirmed, offshore fracking, a toxic mess, from Jacob Chamberlain, staff writer for Common Dreams. Also, this polluter won't pay. The U.S. is the largest polluter on many levels in the world, yet we're not held accountable. We'll deal with that. Two commentaries today, if time permits, from Professor Paul Craig Roberts. What is the real agenda of the American police state? And also, that's from Op-Ed News, and from alternate Amanda Marcotti, the gospel of selfishness in American Christianity. That'll be interesting. And one I'm definitely going to get to today, and that is an in-depth discussion on a man-made mess, tapped out and going dry. Can we live with water's new normal? From Trends Journal, the new issue. From one of the brightest men on the planet, and he's been so accurate so often, Gerald Salante. So as you see, we have a lot to share. And I'm going to be mixing in your calls throughout the entire program. Let's begin. One of the first things that I recommend when people are trying to detoxify, lose weight, turn off inflammatory conditions leading to arthritis, heart disease, dementia, Alzheimer's, Parkinson, is shift from an acid to an alkaline-based diet. I've made up charts. Many of my books now have whole lists, two or three or four pages of these are the foods or beverages that are acid, and these are the foods that are alkaline. Now, you can't have 100% alkaline. Some acid foods are fine, but it depends upon what they are. You don't want an acid food like meat, because meat has another acid in it. It's called arachidonic acid, and that is a real killer. Also, you have acids that will hyperpotentize your hydrochloric acid in your stomach, causing gastric reflux. That's where the acid in your stomach can regurgitate back up into your very sensitive esophagus, and then that can cause irritation, burning, even cancer. But when you start to cleanse and detoxify, here are the foods that you should eliminate from your diet. You should eliminate all meat and all dairy, all highly processed foods, baked foods like toast, bagels, muffins, breads, and artificial sweeteners, coffee. And by the way, interesting, today I was getting my juice for the day, and a woman came over to me and says, "Do you remember me? I was in one of your health support groups about 15 years ago, and I was having a problem, and you put me on a protocol, and I overcame that problem, but I now have these fibrocystic breasts, I have fibroids, and the doctor wants to give me a hysterectomy, and I don't want that." And I said, "Well, what are you doing?" "Well, I'm doing some things, but I can't give up my coffee." And I said, "Are you kidding? Coffee is one of the top two reasons you get fibrocystic breasts, and it really causes fibroids to grow. So if you care enough about your body, give up the coffee." "I don't know if I can do that." "Well, when you start having a growth the size of a grapefruit," which is what she said she has, "remember, every time you drink a cup of coffee, you're actually feeding that tumorous mass." She needs to be on a highly alkalized diet, but most people do. But I don't think most people are going to do it, not to the degree that they should. Here is the latest from Science Daily, confirming much of this. Quote, "Increased consumption of vegetable protein has been linked with prolonged survival among kidney disease patients in this new study. This was presented at the Georgia World Congress Center in Atlanta from the Kidney Association. Now, what do we know? We know that due to poor kidney function, toxins that are normally excreted in the urine can build up in the blood of individuals with chronic kidney disease. We also know that research shows that compared with animal protein, vegetable protein intake in patients is linked with lower production of these toxins. Now, to investigate this, the people at the University of Utah work with 1,100 individuals who had KTD conditions, and through the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, and they examined the quality of their protein. And they found that those that had vegetable proteins did substantially better. Well, here's the bottom line to this. We are a protein-obsessed nation. Today, I was looking at a series of graphs that will be up on my website tomorrow. These graphs were from ads from national magazines, including whole-page ads in the Journal of the American Medical Association. And the first two really drove home the message. One of these was that there was a doctor or a person that was looking like a doctor in a lab coat and stethoscope, could have been an actor or model, saying 46,000 doctors recommend Chesterfields. And another was Ronald Reagan recommending that he gives cigarettes to all of his friends. And how much better a woman will like you if you blow cigarette smoke in her face. Then there were other ads that showed babies drinking 7-Up and colas. And one of the ads says it's never too young to get them started in the right way. Anyhow, I have about 40 of these full ads. And these were played to three successive generations. In fact, the only thing that challenged them was when the feminist movement began to focus upon women's bodies, their health, and how those women had been disempowered, had been manipulated, commodified, commercialized, and were paying a terrible price for them. Today, if you saw an ad on television that had a smiling doctor saying 46,000 doctors recommend that you smoke cigarettes, 2 or 3 packs a day. In fact, one of the ads said that it soothes your throat. Could you imagine the reaction to that ad? Yet when we look at health statistics from the 1930s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, we have to remember that these generations every day had someone selling them something. Now, not everything was bad that was sold. But when it came to cigarettes and other things, you bet. There was even one ad of a little kid with I'm guessing 3 or 4 or 5 years old, with a gun in bed. about how this is, you know, the best toy, but it wasn't a toy gun. It was a real gun. That's how foolish we were, but that's also the power of propagandizing. So when you're told that you need meat, you believe it. I even once had a very famous boxer who boxed for the championship and came up because he wanted to train at my farm upstate New York. And I'd go out and do road work with him, and because I was a marathoner, I could push him to get up those mountains, very hilly up there, and then he would come back and have a protein shake, and he was asking, where's the non-fat dry milk powder? I said, there is none. This is a vegan. He said, I can't do this. I said, sure you can. He said, no. He said, if I'm not having at least 3 big steaks a day, I'll go in the ring and I'll just be weak as can be. I said, no, you won't. And I sat and had a class with him, and I said, look, all protein is a combination of amino acids. It's not protein your body ever requires. It's amino acids, the building blocks of protein. So your muscles, your heart, your liver, your lungs, your brain, this is all based upon amino acids. So we need certain essential amino acids that our body cannot produce. Hence, if you have that can of soybeans there, that'll give you about 26 grams of protein and fiber and B complex and no heavy acids. And you'll feel good and it's easy to digest. Now, if you have that steak, about half that steak is going to be marbleized fat. So you're getting a lot of bad calories. And the meat's hard to digest. It'll take a toll on your kidneys and your liver. And there's no fiber, and it'll play havoc in your intestine. And I said, would you eat a piece of meat that someone had laid out on a table in the summer at 98 degrees? He says, no. I said, well, what do you think's happening after 3 days at 98 degrees and that meat's in your intestine? It's putrefying. There's massive amounts of bad bacteria. No matter what argument I used, even showing him a nutritional textbook that I had studied when I was in school, it didn't convince him. And finally, after just a week, he left. And went because he went to go someplace that would feed him real food, as if this wasn't real food. Anyhow, he got knocked out early in the bout, even having all of his meat. I can remember growing up when you had meat 3 times a day, generally bacon, eggs, and or some form of sausage and eggs in the morning, and a grilled cheese sandwich and lunch, and some form of meat in the evening. Once a week, you'd have fish and big roast beef on Sunday. That's the way people ate. And unfortunately, it was flooding their body with too much fat, arachidonic acids, pro-inflammatory cytokines. And so it was very common for people to have gouty arthritis and muscle aches and pains. And they simply said this was a normal product of aging. It isn't. So when this major study is done and it shows that when you're eating protein from vegetables, then it's easier on your kidneys. Well, of course it's easier on your kidneys, and it's easier on your liver, and it's easier on your heart, and it's easier on your bloodstream, because the amino acids, how they're combined and how they're digested much, much more rapidly, so you're getting the benefit of them, and it's not creating toxic byproducts like urea and ammonium as a meat-based protein would. And kidney patients have to have a very limited amount of certain minerals and protein. And so that's one thing that they're now finding. But this has been common knowledge within the health community and the hygienic community for 80 years, 90 years. At least they're catching up, and that's a good thing. What we're not catching up with is that artificial sweeteners should not be used, the synthetic artificial sweeteners. We've done multiple programs, and I've written several articles about the dangers of artificial sweeteners. But that doesn't mean that all sweeteners are bad, and even low-caloric sweeteners like stevia is great, but also xylitol. Xylitol, L-I-T-O-L. Xylitol it's terrific. And here's what it does compared to all the other sugars or artificial sweeteners, most of which are often like high fructose corn syrup, including aspartame, come from genetic modified organisms, including corn syrup. And those are dangerous to our health. According to the latest survey, 50% of Americans were consuming at least a half a pound of refined sugar every day in food and drinks. That's an incredible 180 pounds of refined sugar per year. What happens when you consume all this sugar in food or drink? Well, several things. It causes acidosis, and that can cause all forms of other illnesses or exacerbates them. It creates pathogenic bad bacteria in your gut, and that weakens your immune system. It feeds cancer cells. And I saw the American Cancer Society put out information that sugar doesn't feed cancer cells. I will be writing and releasing a fully documented, footnoted article showing they're completely wrong. And by the way, that wouldn't be the first time they're wrong about most things, including that they have any knowledge of cancer treatment that works. It causes tooth decay, contributes to diabetes, contributes to obesity, and ends up causing you fatigue. It affects your brain, and it leaches vitamins and minerals from bones and other parts of the body, and it converts to fatty acids, which are deposited in your heart, your kidneys, and your other organs. There are a lot of deleterious effects to your health. But there are other sweeteners that are not contributing to ill health. Maple syrup, stevia, molasses, crude molasses, and natural sweeteners directly from fruit. Those actually contribute to good bacteria, strengthen the immune system, and cause the body to be more alkaline. And then we have xylitol. Xylitol is so different from sugar. And here's what xylitol does. First, it tastes and looks exactly like sugar, but it's not a sugar at all. Instead, it's a sugar alcohol. Now, that doesn't mean that there's any alcoholic aspect to it. It's not. It merely means it contains 5 carbon atoms as opposed to 6 carbon atoms of sugar. And xylitol is all natural. It was extracted mostly from the bark of the birch trees, the original source, but it's also made from fibrous vegetables. And I wouldn't use a lot of it, but certainly to use it as in ways that are reasonable. And here's why I would use xylitol. It's suitable to diabetics due to its low glycemic index. It is both antibacterial and antiviral and protects against fighting infections. It's antifungal. It fights candida, yeast, and other infections. It's alkalizing, therefore helping to maintain the body at a healthy alkaline pH. It is a probiotic, the good bacteria to strengthen your immune system. It's an antipathogenic microbial, killing bad microbes that weaken the immune system. It stabilizes insulin and hormone levels in harmony with the endocrine system. It reduces craving for food and calories, and thereby helps with weight loss. And it's beneficial helping sinus, ear, and nose infections. So xylitol, X-Y-L-I-T-O-L. And also, before I take my first call here, I want to tell you about something that they're testing with cancer. This is from Natural News. It's called Nigella, N-I-G-E-L-L-A, sativa, S-A-T-I-V-A. Here's what they say. Quote, much to the dismay of many pharmaceutical giants and doctors who reap big rebate checks from recommending chemotherapy treatments, Nigella has been proven over and over again to successfully treat cancer without the use of conventional treatments. Nigella has been shown to be effective against numerous cancers such as pancreatic cancer, colon, prostate, breast, and even brain cancers. Indeed, Nigella is cancer's worst nightmare and a ray of hope for people who may have died otherwise. Now, why is this? It's simple. Statistics show that the success rate of people using chemotherapy over a 5-year period is, are you ready? 2.1%. Let me repeat that, because you're not going to see any of this anywhere in the media. The 5-year success rate of using chemotherapy is only 2.1%. Nigella sativa, on the other hand, was proven to annihilate pancreatic tumor cells at the rate of over 80%. Chemotherapy has many side effects. One of the side effects is the possibility of secondary cancers. Secondary cancers are very aggressive and may occur from tumor receding. Nigella not only rebuilds the immune system and destroys cancer cells, it reinforces the good cells to fight the cancer. Needless to say, it is imperative to treat the cancer patients immediately or in the early stages if possible. So that is an important update on that. And presently there are 462 papers in the scientific literature on the efficacy of Nigella sativa. All right, and there have been multiple studies on the effect of Nigella and its anti-tumor capabilities. In fact, in 1997 at the Cancer Research Facility at Hilton Head Island, Nigella was proven to have enormous capability in tumor cell death. Colon cancer, breast cancer, pancreatic cancer, it was able to have remarkable benefits. So I just want you to know the latest on that. I'm Gary Knoll. Now on to an environmental issue. This comes from Curtis Reese of Truth Out. As you know, we are amongst many individuals out there, mainly lay people, who are fighting to educate the public, their neighbors, their co-workers, about the dangers of genetically engineered organisms. We barely lost in California and in Washington against tremendous odds. And that's the power of propaganda and unlimited budgets to buy television ads to scare people. Most people, if they saw the truth, would act on it when it came to GMOs. It's not what GMOs are that should demand so much attention, but rather what they do. They lead to corporate control over the food system. An editorial in Science magazine from this September has come in out in strong defense of GMO biotechnology, criticizing the destruction of experimental genetically modified golden rice fields in the Philippines by protesters. They call them vandals. Well, since then, the blogosphere has erupted with condemners and defenders once again accusing each other of ascribing to bad science, being ideological driven and profiteering from their respective movements. But while the narrow debate rages on about the inherent safety or harm of GMOs to humans and the environment, the more fundamental issue of the specific role of GMOs playing within the greater context of a globalized and industrialized agriculture is left virtually without comment. The editorial entitled Stand Up for GMOs is sponsored by 11 scientists and focuses on the potential utility of golden rice, ultimately using it to portray GMO technology in general as a valuable tool that society should use because of its, quote, potential to save millions of impoverished fellow humans from needless suffering and death. Well, this type of narrow analysis, focusing almost singularly on the dormant ability of GMO crops to feed and nutritionally supplement the world's growing population, is astonishingly selective and therefore significantly misleading. It is a far cry from seeing how GMO technology actually functions within the broader framework of industrialized agriculture, a model of production that is completely focused on profits, efficiency, and yields rather than on the health of people and places. Ignorance of this broader framework is revealed in the editorial when its writers claim, quote, precisely because they benefit farmers, the environment, and consumers, GMO crops have been adopted to faster movement of agricultural advances in the history of humanity. Although it is certainly true that GMO crops have been adopted rapidly the world over in recent decades, it is a mistake and a deception to claim that this is because of supposed benefits to farmers, consumers, and the environment. Just look at the general characteristics and history of agriculture in the past half century, and let's set the record straight. First, to all the farmers and consumers. It is difficult to fathom at this time how GMO technology could be construed to be a boon to farmers. For decades, the American countryside has been gutted of its farmers and farming communities by the relentless march of agribusiness's imperatives to produce more food more efficiently without the human or the environmental cost. In his book, Deep Economy, Bill McKibben, who I've on this program many times, drives the point home, quote, since the end of World War II, America has lost a farm every half hour. Let me repeat that. Since the end of World War II, 1945, America has lost a farm every half hour. The number of farmers has fallen from half the American population to about 1%. Now, this mammoth feat of rural destruction has been achieved by replacing diverse small family farms with homogeneous industrial monocultures on the basic unit of agriculture production. Now, this audience knows that a monoculture, usually enormous, is a single crop with no crop rotation. And you put your seed in the ground, you put the same seed in the ground, you harvest at a particular time. And GMO technology has played no small role in facilitating capitalizing on the transition to monoculture, because GM crops are most often genetically manipulated to do one of two things: resist potent broad-spectrum chemical herbicides like Monsanto's Roundup, which is designed to kill any and all non-modified plant life, and to harbor bacterial genes that produce toxins lethal to pests that consume the GM crop. Both of these biotechnological innovations provide invaluable service to the industry as a model of agriculture, because they remedy in the short term inherent vulnerabilities of monoculture production. Continual tilling, watering, and fertilizing, as well as leaving broken soil bare without cover, invariably will lead to weed problems. Similarly, planting the same one or two crops in constant repetition invariably will lead to pests and disease problems. Something diverse farms with a deliberate crop rotation strategy usually can mitigate. Thus, GMO biotechnology, as is most commonly applied, is wrapped and bound within the context of the industrial monoculture, which by its own inherent qualities of lacking diversity, eroding, compacting, and depleting soils, and requiring enormous quantities of petroleum for fuel and chemicals, is deeply destructive and unsustainable. Now, these monocultures have forcibly replaced the energy and intelligence of farmers with the energy of oil and the insights of biotechnology and the short-sighted profit-seeking of agribusiness. That's resulted in millions of farmers being driven off the land by capitalistic economic imperatives for growth and maximum production. And as a further insult to farmers, GMO biotechnology has evolved along parallel lines with a set of legal protections that have codified genetically modified seeds as intellectual property, that is, as the patented products of the GM seed and chemical companies that develop their genetic modifications. These multinational corporations make enormous profits selling farmers their GM seeds year after year, and yet more profits off the royalties charged for the use of their seed at the expense of farmers, who now cannot legally save their own seeds, making them entirely dependent upon a private corporation for the most fundamental part of their livelihoods. This perverts the tradition central to agriculture, which has existed since its inception. It's called seed saving. Farmers saving seeds from plants that displayed favorable traits and replanting those seeds season after season had developed diverse varieties to a specific and social cultural needs and climate. Let me just show you how simple it is. It's this simple. You grow tomato. Let's say you have an heirloom organic tomato. And you open up a bunch of the tomatoes, and you find that in 100 tomatoes you have 10,000 seeds. Let's use this as an example. You take those seeds, you dry them, and now those become the seed stock that you can use for the next seed season. You could plant, with 10,000 seeds, you could plant a whole acre of tomatoes, 2 or 3 acres of tomatoes. But today, when you buy a genetically engineered tomato, it has a terminator seed in it, meaning you have to next year buy that same seed all over again. Well, if you're wealthy, you can do that. But what about all the poor farmers of the world who have historically always had the seeds of 1 year saved for the next year? They can't do that. And as a result, if there's drought, if there's flooding, if there's any problem, they not only lose this year's crop, they don't have money for next year's crop. And as a result, over 260,000 men in India alone in the cotton belt have committed suicide, frequently by drinking pesticides. Not very nice. And yet we don't even talk about it in our society. And we should. I'm Gary Knoll. We're going to now go to your telephone calls. Let's say hello to Eric from Pennsylvania. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Gary. Thanks so much for everything. I had a question. A few weeks ago, you mentioned a study about leucine helping extremely well for the elderly to reverse muscle wasting. And I was wondering if you could suggest a protocol for, let's say, a light, like 100-pound elderly person, female, to reverse muscle wasting.
All right. Well, it depends upon why the person is wasting. If you have cancer, a common wasting condition is called cachexia, in which case you'd have to look at hydrogen sulfate and some other nutrients that only a doctor could give and other drugs that could block the process. Then you want to turn off inflammation within the cells, including in the intestine with black cumin seed oil. Then you'd want to rebuild the intestine because a lot of older people have a hard time digesting food, and they have lost a lot of the facilitation of normal absorption. And hence, I would look at the probiotics to create a really healthy bacterial medium, which enhances digestion. I would also look at having some of their food blended, where you put tomatoes and garlic and onion and cucumbers, and maybe some beans, easy-to-digest beans would be a soybean or a chickpea, and a little bit of olive oil and flaxseed oil, and you blend that up to taste and with lemon juice. And then you have them eat that because you'll get a higher assimilation of the nutrients. Glutamine is very important, generally 2,000 to 3,000 milligrams, but so too is D-ribose, 2,000 to 3,000 milligrams. And I would also use the core of the pineapple in a drink by itself, where I put papaya, core of pineapple together, and pomegranate, and drink that. I would also have a cabbage juice each day, and then about 3 times a day, I would use creatine monohydrate along with a good quality vegetable protein. Now, it may come from hemp or let's say rice, a pea, or a split pea, or all soy, if it's all organic and none of it's genetically engineered. And for an older person, probably I'd go about 15 grams of protein. And I would also include in there some of the omega-3 fatty acids and some coconut oil, and then use a liquid medium like a rice milk. So that's how I would go about rebuilding the musculature and putting on some weight. But I would have the person doing some weight work. I'd have them doing some resisting exercising. And I would take the protein shake within 20 minutes after the workout to expand the protoplasm of the cell and to get some cell density going. All right? All the best, Eric, from Pennsylvania. Now I'm going to take a moment because I said I was going to definitely give you something on the environment. This comes from the current issue of Trends Journal, which, for those of you who want to know the likely outcome of what's going on in the future, should pay some attention to this. And this is from Gerald Salante. It's called Man-Made Mess, Tapped Out and Going Dry. Can We Live with Water's New Normal? And here's what it says. It says, from Australia to Mexico to Sub-Saharan Africa, the world is gripped by a shortage of fresh, clean water. The evidence is everywhere. Up to 80% of China's rivers are now so polluted they no longer support aquatic life. NASA satellite photos indicate that India's water table is shrinking as much as a foot each year, even while the nation's government plans massive investments in even more irrigation projects. Mexico City, built atop an aquifer, is sinking into the ground as it drains the last of the waters they have supported. Deserts are spreading in Peru, Bolivia, and parts of Argentina. The worst of the shortage is in Africa, where almost 40% of people live with a scarcity of clean water. Experts estimate that by 2030, the continent's water shortages could turn as many as 700 million people into migrants or refugees. The United Nations estimates that by 2025, almost a third of the world's people will face acute water shortages, and another third could be close to that situation. Within 15 years from now, the world's rapidly shrinking supplies of fresh water could result in political instability, health and hunger emergencies, and stunted economic development. That's according to the Global World Crisis. And a report was just released by 40 world leaders and heads of state on this. Quote, they say, the future impact of water scarcity may be devastating. That was from Jean Chrétien, one of the authors. Quote, using water the way we have in the past simply will not sustain humanity in the future. End quote. And the U.S. isn't being spared. Texas and Oklahoma have asked the Supreme Court to decide if Oklahoma has the right to deny Texas access to tributaries of the Red River, which separates parts of the two states, to quench the thirst of the growing Fort Worth area. Georgia, Alabama, and Florida each are grabbing for disproportionate shares of the drought-plagued Chattahoochee River system, a battle that has collapsed Florida's river fishery and prompted Governor Rick Scott to ask the federal government to declare it a disaster. Climate shifts, growing populations, simple waste, and the other ills drying the planet won't spare the United States. But North Americans are beginning to discover how to live in a world normal that is more arid and thirstier than the one we've known. Computer models predict that the climate is in most of the United States will become drier and will be marked by more frequent extreme weather events. A drier U.S. means less water available as liquid to recharge water tables, growing crops, to impact boaters and everyone else, even sprinkling your suburban lawns. Now, although the northeastern United States is predicted to become slightly wetter than previously, its weather pattern is changing. In the past, snow blankets accumulating through winters have melted gradually in the spring, renewing soil and underground reservoirs. The slightly warmer temperatures ahead result in a precipitation coming in the form of cold rains that wash away the frozen ground. Summer rains are forecast to be more frequently falling as heavy downpours that soak the ground to capacity, with excess water running off instead of staying in the soil to nourish ground and subsurface water stores. Denver, Atlanta, and other cities are making hard choices and taking steps to live in this more arid new world. Some changes are as simple as replacing the hardware in public restrooms. Others involve complex, sometimes acrimonious arguments among states that bring everyone to court. But much of North America remains unprepared for a drier future, even though adaptations are being crafted in dozens of localities across the continent. Now, I'll give one case here. California. Left to nature, parts of California will be as parched as the Middle East. Let me repeat this. Left to nature, parts of California will be as parched as the Middle East. But the state has been fashioned as a lush paradise by commandeering water from 157 million acres across eight states and funneling it through a web of tunnels, canals, and aqueducts. That creation of a solution is no longer enough. The snowpack in the Sierra Mountains, the main water reserve for the state, is dwindling year by year. The San Francisco Bay Delta, a key source of water for the state's urban centers, and thousands of farms in the state's Central Valley, which grow more than a third of all U.S. commercial produce, is under environmental protections that divert billions of gallons to protect endangered fish species. Mike Wade, executive director of the California Farm Water Coalition, estimates that the state's farmers have lost more than 650 billion gallons of water every year due to drought, mandates to share water with other users, and permanent loss of supplies. As a result, farmers will expend what precious water they have on permanent plantings such as orchards and vineyards. One-off crops such as lettuce and broccoli and feed crops for pork, beef, and dairy producers simply won't be planted. This is likely to create short supplies of these very pricey foods. In some ways, California's permanent water shortage has already changed crop patterns. Growers are giving up water-intense, low-profit crops such as cotton and rice and switching to permanent, higher-profit crops such as almonds and pistachios. They're also investing in water-smart strategies such as underground drip irrigation that reduces evaporation losses while also increasing production. The lack of water also extends to cities, and here in California, California is going with the flow. Over the last two decades, the Los Angeles area has added 1 million people without increasing its water consumption. Among conservation strategies, the city encourages residents to replace grass lawns with drought-tolerant plantings and requires large water users such as laundries and car washes to recycle their water. The city of Long Beach pays residents $3 a square foot to yank out conventional grass and replace it with drought-resistant plantings such as agave. Similar strategies are in place statewide. And the California legislature mandated that municipalities reduce their water use by 20% within the next 5 years. Not only is that providing to be a realistic goal, but several cities have already passed a 20% milestone. The city of Santa Monica has cleaned up its groundwater supplies, allowing it to open 5 additional town wells, and is planning to harvest and store rainwater, among other strategies. Other cities are saving water by requiring water recycling and allowing the use of only permeable paving materials. Long Beach recycles 25 million gallons of water a day for use in irrigation and similar purposes, and some have begun metering water use, allowing them not only to discover how much they're using, but also to pinpoint leaks in their pipes. The most powerful solution to California's permanent water shortage isn't more dams or magic technology. Quote, there are simple steps we can take throughout California that can save a lot of water, says Kate Pools, senior attorney with the National Resources Defense Council's Wildlife and Water. And then it goes into other parts of the country as well. But there are some places where you're just not going to have water, and you should be very conscious of that. Some of those places include Colorado, Oklahoma, Kansas, Nevada, Utah, South Dakota, Wyoming, New Mexico, about half of Texas, most of Florida, down to about around the Fort Myers area, and Georgia, Alabama, and South Carolina. You're running out of water. And it's not will you run out, it's when. And then there'll be all kinds of lawsuits. I'm Gary Nall, and let's say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. Well, you have got to tell us what the heck went on this afternoon. I understand that you had a film showing today out in Huntington on Long Island, and my emails just got clogged with people praising you and up and down, and thank you for speaking out, and you've got to tell us what went on.
All right. Well, when I went to the theater for the premiere of The Silent Epidemic, The Truth About Vaccines, the theater owner told me that she had had calls from angry doctors who did not believe that the show should be seen, that I should be there, And she said, I'm sorry to say this, but these are very angry doctors. And I said, that's fine. She said, well, they're inside waiting on you. I said, that's fine. So when the movie was over and I went up on stage, I said, I understand that there are some doctors here who tried to stop this from being shown. So I'm going to give you an opportunity to attack me personally and to attack the film. Just stand up so we know who you are and raise your concerns and we'll listen to you. And so this guy stood up. He's a medical doctor, pediatrician, and he went on and on and on. And are you a medical doctor? No, sir, I'm not. Are you, do you treat patients? No, I don't. Have you seen, and he went through this whole litany of, have you ever seen a person who came down with a disease that the vaccine could have cured and who got sick or died? And I said, no. So after he made, you know, his volley of accusations, I then asked him, I said, I've studied every single scientific peer-reviewed literature on vaccines. Could you show me a single article in all the literature that is a double-blind placebo-controlled study of one vaccine compared with a person who was not vaccinated? There is none. So the entire so-called science of safety and efficacy simply does not exist. To your statement that, you know, we know they work because they create antibodies. Well, I've interviewed multiple immunologists, toxicologists, and vaccinologists who show you that, to the contrary, that yes, they will stimulate the immune system and create antibodies, but you cannot predict that these antibodies are protective. In point of fact, sir, in recent times, cases of fully vaccinated measles persons came down with measles in a more violent form. Chickenpox, a more violent form. Whooping cough, a more violent form. He said, that's not true. I said, it is true. And this was reported in the New England Journal of Medicine, the Journal of the American Medical Association, New York Times. It's all over the literature. And so that might seem like an anomaly. And you may say, well, that's of idiopathic origin. What means unknown origin? How is it that if a vaccine is supposed to work and you've had the full series of vaccines, one, two, three shots, booster shots, and you still come down with a condition and they all had antibodies, how can you say then that the antibodies were protective? I said, I believe in natural immunity. I don't tell people not to vaccinate. I merely give them insights and information they would not have otherwise have so that their ability to make an intelligent, reasoned choice is at least more balanced. And then he says, well, I'll give you a good example. And I said, he says, then what's the average life expectancy? And I told him what the average life expectancy was. And he said, but see, that's the problem. Look at what it was, you know, 70 years ago. And I said, okay, let's look at 70 years ago. I'm even going to go back further. Let's look in the 1800s, the mid-1800s. Let's take London and Paris as two examples. There was no indoor plumbing anywhere. There was no indoor bathrooms. There was no indoor water. All the water was polluted because the only water you had was not a healthy, clean mineral water from a deep well. It came from the river. In Paris alone, there were 65,000 open cesspools. I said, do you know what a cesspool is? A cesspool is a hole in the ground, and there was one on almost every block where people would take their defecation every day and throw it in there. And it's not to take away from their culinary qualities or their artistic qualities, but it means that they were a very smelly, unhygienic, dirty group of people. So between lack of hygiene, between polluted water and no good nutrition, you had a mass of society. This average lifespan was 30 years of age. Now, we got in some laws. We cleaned up the water. We cleaned up the milk. We cleaned up the roads. We got indoor plumbing. And that's what caused reduction in diseases. We had no vaccine for scarlet fever, yet we got over it. We had no vaccine for typhoid, we got over it. We had none of the vaccines for major diseases, including cholera, but we got over it. I said, you want to cause cholera? We have an epidemic of cholera in Haiti. It was caused by the UN troops defecating in the water there, and the water downstream was drank by the people and the natives, and it ended up affecting over 100,000 of them, and thousands have died. The UN is yet to take this up as an issue and compensate the people or change the circumstances of it in order to put in proper water filtration, irrespective of the billions of dollars. I said, and also when my mother was growing up in the 1920s and 30s, she was conditioned to smoke, but every one of her siblings and all of her other relatives smoke because it was considered normal, and drink, it was normal, and eat a high-protein, high-fat diet, it was normal, and not to exercise, that was considered normal, and to hold your stress in and never let anyone know what you were feeling, that was normal. As a result, all of our generation, my parents' generation, they died young. Rare when they would live a long and happy life, and yes, unless they had the freedom from this conditioned response. So if you're going to say because of today, persons living longer, they're living longer because medicine can interfere in the disease process to allow people to live longer, but not a better quality of life. You're not mentioning the fact that we're the sickest nation in the world. We spend $3.3 trillion on disease. And in the process of all this, we have an epidemic of children who have diabetes. And you're a pediatrician. What are you doing to this? And then the idea that somehow I'm not a MD gives me no right to an opinion and no responsibility to be authoritative is condescending. Sir, I earned a PhD with honors, and how do you get a PhD in public health science? You have to prove to nine professors and medical doctors that you have mastered a field. That means I had to contribute something unique and different than anyone else for them to say you have deserved the right to be called a doctor. You are a medical doctor. All of you are on assembly line. When was the last time a doctor actually thought outside of the limited restraints of a conditioned propagandizing, when the courses you're taught frequently are chaired by people who are receiving grants from pharmaceutical companies? I said, to me, it is contemptible that you as a physician would allow 60,000 people to die from one drug Vioxx, and not a single one of the arrogant and duplicitous rheumatologists would ever apologize. And he didn't know what Vioxx was. I says, you mean you don't know the biggest mass killing? And also, you talk about medicine as if it is the only standard by which we could qualify the truth. Well, how is it that you've had control over the war on cancer for 40 years, and there are still going to be 550,000 people dying of cancer this year? At the end of 20 years, that's over 7 million dead. How can you continue even pretending you know what you're doing when you have massive medical genocide? The number one cause of death in the United States is not heart attacks, it's not stroke, it's not cancer, it's not diabetes, it is doctor-induced, up to 700,000 with over 15 million injuries. So when you can't correct yourself, when you cannot acknowledge your own limitation, when you cannot acknowledge that the patient may have better understanding of the cause and effect of a disease in their own children, when you take the total responsibility for dictating what is right and wrong, and you're the only arbiter of the truth, then, sir, I will not call that medicine. And that's how it went. And every time he threw an argument, I rebutted it, and this went on for about 45 minutes. And I thanked him for having at least the courage to stand up and argue publicly. I said, it doesn't take a whole lot of courage to engage in medical McCarthyism. In my world, if I have an issue with someone, I'll take them on publicly, and the people can decide the merits or demerits of anyone's argument. If this film had never been shown here, think of all the people who would not have known the truth. And some woman stood up, and she said, I'm a medical doctor, and I'm a PhD, MD, PhD. And she said, and I've seen the damage of vaccines, and I'm glad I came, because everyone on that screen, every person on that screen was a qualified medic. I said, I brought people in. Look, Harvard, Yale, the top academic institutions, they're the ones who are telling you. I'm not even in my own film. You don't see me once in my film. I brought them in. So why don't you go argue with them if you don't believe that vaccines are dangerous? And he left without any thought that the vaccines are actually dangerous, and that it's dangerous not to get your vaccine, which is his right. It's anyone's right to take their vaccines or not. It's not his right to assume that he has truth on his side because he is an MD after his name. If you're going to take the position that you have a right to be right because you have an MD after your name, then take the responsibility for saying I'm sorry for every patient you've injured or has died because of medical malfeasance. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening.